Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. And on this week's programme, we ask, do the English cousins still visit Irish farms? We find out how you grow a community garden, and we learn a new Wicklow way for using Irish wool for knitting and weaving. And yes, good morning to you wherever you are, whether you're just coming in from milking or you're making the most of this fine weather to harvest your crops, or God help us, heaven help us, you're crouched over your laptop trying to buy your tickets for Oasis. Whatever you're doing, we are here to keep you company until 9 a.m. But first, Jill Smith farms near Carrickaline in County Cork. She's milked her cows all her life, and she was instrumental in saving the Drummond cow, which is a native Irish breed. The world around her is changing, and she is now retired. So Jill has a tough decision to make about the future of her herd. Ella McSweeney called to visit her on the eve of most of her cows leaving the farm. But Jill has always made her own decisions in her farming life and has made her own decision about their future too.
So you got ducks as well, have you?
Just a couple. They came to me because the fox killed their brothers and sisters, so they were brought to me that way. And actually that cock there, that he came from Kerry. A couple brought him up to me 2 years ago. Yeah, he came up, he's a Kerry cock as we call him.
He looks like he's got a lot of self-confidence.
Oh, he has. Yeah. Oh, he is. He is. Typical Kerry man.
Jill Smith's farm is right on the edge of the rapidly expanding town of Carrickaline in Cork. Now retired, and with the ever-growing sound of urbanisation increasing around her fields, she faces decisions about her farm's future. Most importantly for her, what will happen to her herd of cows?
I suppose when I was just turned 70, I kind of said, you know, there's a lot of animals here. Like, my parents died in their early 70s, and I kind of, you know, I said, it could be near my time as well. But thankfully, I've got another 7 years out of it since. And I decided then, what was I going to do with all my cows that I loved dearly? I was looking at the country file and I saw where there was a man surrendered his pedigree Herefords to a sanctuary. So when country file was over, I rang my sister who lives in Kent. I said, I've got the name, Hillside Animal Sanctuary. Can you get a phone number for me? So she did. I rang Wendy Valentine, who owns the sanctuary. And I said, told her my predicament. I said, I have dairy cows and I'd like them to go. She said, no problem. As soon as you can get your arrangements done, we'll take them. We'd sent out 70, I think, the first time. There's a load going tomorrow, and that would be our fifth load of cows going to the sanctuary.
I suppose the obvious question is, why are you doing this? Usually what happens to cows that are finished milking or whatever is that they're either sold on or they're generally sent to the factory. Why wouldn't you do that?
Well, I did it all my life. And it would be the hardest day that I'd put down the day the lorry would take them to the factory. It would break my heart to see them going. And I felt I could not send the whole herd there. I think I wouldn't have survived. They gave me a good life. I had a lovely life. I enjoyed my life. I loved milking cows. I loved being with the animals. I milked cows every Christmas day. I never had a weekend away or anything like that. I stayed with the cows. Very happy to do it, no regrets at all. But it was always the hard day that they had to go. But financially, I had to. And economically, I had to just get rid of them. They had to go, pay the bills and feed the ones that were left at home. So that's what happened.
What's the feeling when they go from the farm here for you, when you know that they're going across the water to this retirement home?
Well, they're going out tomorrow. Half of me will be smiling. And the other half, the tears will be dripping. And that's it. The sad thing about it, we have no sanctuary in this country, which I would love if we had, that we could send them to a retirement home here, where there is no place in Ireland to take them. It will be a long journey for them, but I know they'll be straight away. They'll be in comfort what they'll land over, and I'm happy then. You know, when I see the lorry pulling away tomorrow, and I see the ramp going up, I say, I'll see you girls no more, and that's it. I'm happy at the other side, thinking that just they're safe. They're safe. I'm just giving a little bit of food to the geese for their midday snack. Well, I don't go looking for them. They just arrive.
How do they arrive then?
They come in boots of cars and baskets in paper bags, you name it.
Do you mind?
No, no. No, never. Never. I'll refuse nothing. They'll never go back. Muggies! 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 Muggies!
Can you look at your cows?
Well, we have over 30 cattle here at the moment, and 25 of those are going tomorrow.
And here they are. We might just go in through the gate there, Jill. Cattle are in their pens. What breed are they, Jill?
There are some Jerseys, some Friesian. She's a brown Swiss, the one with the horns. A couple of my old retired Drummond cattle. They're going
Native Irish.
Native Irish. Yeah. There's, I think, a couple of Shorthorns as well going, there are.
So 25 of them are gone?
Yeah. Well, it'll be big pressure off before the winter. So I have to be careful, my poor old ticker.
Yes.
She's getting tender this age. So I'll have about 12 or 14 cattle for the winter, and that will be lovely. Easy managed.
Here they are now, they're coming up to you like dogs.
That's Ivy. Ivy is a Jersey. She's a twin. Holly. Where's Holly? Holly!
Do you have names on all of them?
Yeah, that's Mikey. And the black fellow is Chloe. They thought he was a girl, but I'm afraid he's a boy. So
it's a nice name.
Chloe. We'll just come over and you can rub Chloe. He's lovely. That's Tiny.
Because he is tiny?
She's tiny. Mm.
They're very calm, aren't they?
Yeah, he's lovely. He's gorgeous. I'll be lonesome when he'll go.
Will you?
But I love him because he's such a pet.
There's a German behind him, I presume.
There's three of them. They're together, actually.
They're beautiful.
They're all going now tomorrow.
I mean, you were very central in keeping that breed alive, weren't you, over the years?
Yes, through tough times. Tough times. It was very hard to get them recognised that they were a true breed. And it took a good bit of my lifetime to keep pushing on my own. And I kept pushing. And then a few people came on board and, you know, we had a few stops and starts, but we got going eventually.
And got there eventually.
We got there, and they are recognised as a distinct breed, real ancient breed. Mm. And they have a lot of their own characters about them compared to these big fat fellas here.
And Jill, one of the things that really strikes me about your land here is the grasses look very old. And I say that not that they look tatty, but that they look very interesting. Old grass species.
Yeah, the grass, the youngest field I'd have would be, I suppose, 40 years.
So you haven't reseeded?
No. You know, we have, as I said, we have grasshoppers. Even I was talking to one of my neighbours the other day and I said, do you have grasshoppers? I don't know what you're talking about. And he's a farmer. He said, I never saw a grasshopper. It's lovely to hear them on the fine day.
So what do you think the future has for this farm? And I don't say that because you're going anywhere soon, you certainly are not, but long term.
I had a dream years ago of turning it into a sort of a rest walk, you know, that people come, walk, bring their kids, bring their dog, put in an area that you could leave dogs run free.
So if the council came to you and said, we might like to do that and call it Jill's Park or Jill's
I would love it. I would love it. It's very hard for us people to touch those people that are in a sad place. And there's a lot of people in sad places. And I would love if we had some place that people could come, have a quiet moment, sit by the bank of the river, think about their loved ones that are gone, have a cup of coffee and a chat with somebody that could talk to them. I would love that.
Take me to your favourite cow.
Sunday. This is Sunday. She was born Sunday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning when we had to call the neighbours to get her into the world. Her mother was not well before she had her and she was not going to survive. So she had to be reared in the kitchen by the fire. She was so small and cold.
Did
it was cold.
You rear her?
I reared her in the kitchen. She was asleep by the fire. But she's my baby.
Yeah. Is she going tomorrow?
No. I I tested her and I did the paperwork, but I got cold feet. I said, no, I leave Sunday.
Is she staying with you?
She's staying with me for as long as I'll be around.
So this time tomorrow night, Jill, 25 of your animals will be gone.
I'll miss them, you know. All the ones that went out, I can remember every one of them. I know the characters of them all and the colour of them all. If you could just say to me, there's this cow or that cow, I would straight away remember. I remember them all, and I do think of them very often. Yeah.
Well, that was Ella McSweeney walking the fields with Jill Smith. And I was chatting to Ella yesterday and we were both saying, God, we'd love to do that rest walk with Jill. What a brilliant idea. And we caught up with Jill, who tells us she's going to miss the cows around the place. But everything went a dream. She said they were loaded up in the trailer and she just looked at them and she said, good luck and good home. Thank you very much, Ella and Jill as well. Now, the children are back in school, and in years past, that would have included the townie cousins, that's me, who spent the summer on their grandparents' or aunts' or uncle's farm down the country. Amongst their number would have been children who travelled from England or Scotland or even further afield to make the pilgrimage to their home place. I wonder, does it still happen? I don't think it does as much, but text us 51551 or you can email countrywide@rte.ie. Here's one cousin from Manchester explaining to Gay Byrne what those childhood summers meant to him when he was a very young boy called Noel Gallagher, who used to travel back to County Mayo.
How Irish do you reckon you are?
I'm half. Because I was born and raised in Manchester, but yeah. My mother...
From Charlestown
in County Mayo.
Yeah, and your dad from
Deleek in Meath. So that makes me exactly half. Although which half it is.
Indeed. No. So you were back in Charlestown a lot, though, were you not?
When we used to have 6 weeks holidays in England for the school summer, my mum used to religiously drag us by the ear hole across the Irish Sea for 6 weeks because we'd never seen the likes of nettles and fields and stacks of hay and all that. And she was determined to give us a bit of Irish culture because we were used to like concrete and flats and stuff. And it was a bit of a culture shock for about the first 4 or 5 years, but we just grew to love it. You know, I mean, I still do to this day. And the great thing the other day was when we came in for the airport. You know that smell that's in the air when the turf's burning? It's like, as soon as you smell that, it's like, almost brings a tear to your eye, you know, it just reminds you of your childhood.
Yes, Noel Gallagher there. And one man who's very fond memories of his own country cousins coming over for the summer is Jim O'Brien, author and columnist with The Farming Independent. Good morning to you, Jim. Are you crouched over a laptop?
I'm not, Brenda. My good wife is, but I'm not. And
I knew she had a reason. Yeah, go ahead.
she was in the waiting room the last time I spoke to her. So,
along with 800,000 others, just that I looked there online. Now, let's talk about this whole country cousins thing. We heard Noel Gallagher there talking about mm-hmm. coming over and the summers in Ireland and the connection that he feels for Ireland. But what are your own memories, Jim?
Well, Brenda, all my father's family emigrated to the States, so we always had visitors for the summer. And the summer, I think, the summer in Ireland was characterised, in rural Ireland, was characterised by visiting people coming to visit. I remember I had one aunt in particular would come for about 5 or 6 weeks, and in fact, she used to come so often and so regularly, she bought a car and left it here, and a Morris Minor, and we called it Daisy May, and we all learned how to drive in Daisy May. And then relatives of my mother used to come religiously every summer from Dublin, and they would arrive for a visit and they'd go to all the relatives around. And I think it was something to do with, you know, maintaining the connection where they came from and who they were. And it was very important for us to know who their names were, that we had these relatives, and make all those connections. So I think the sense of place for them was very important. And I remember as well, I remember there was a Dublin relative of my grandfather. Now, I don't even know their second name still, but my memory is he used to be known as Dublin Dick. And Dublin Dick would arrive. And Dublin Dick was, he was a classy bald man, a man he had a head like Kojak on him that was polished, very distinctive. And he always had a very fine car. I think he was in the motor trade. He always had a Ford Zephyr or a Ford Zodiac, as distinct from our machine that had bales of hay sticking out of the boot and covered in mud and all that sort of thing. But I do remember those times, and I do remember that connection, you know, with our cousins from different parts of the world and from different parts of Ireland. And they felt it was very important to make that connection and maintain that connection as well.
It's funny because I'm now remembering we would be sent to my Auntie Pauline's farm for a week or two, and then we'd be sent to another aunt down in Loughlin Bridge for a week or two. And it's just dawned on me, much cheaper than a summer camp nowadays, when you can go and you can do that. That was a great way that kind of families had of, I suppose, making the summer last, as well as those very important connections. It's kind of woven into our culture, though, of the two islands we have. We've Martin McDonagh, playwright and filmmaker. Ed Sheeran, I think his granny was Wexford. And of course, you just heard Noel Gallagher there. But it really is a part of that link between the two countries.
It is, and it's very interesting that Martin McDonagh, for instance, all his plays are written in the idiom of his parents, because his parents were Irish speakers, or where they came from in Lettermore. And that's where he got all the language in his plays. I remember a really distinct line of Pato in The Beauty Queen of Lennan, wondering whether he would go back to England or whether he'd stay in Ireland. And I remember the phrase was, it was a monologue in one part of the play on the night before he left to go back to England. And he said, "When 'tis there I am, 'tis here I want to be. And when 'tis here I am, 'tis there I want to be." And there is that huge connection between the two islands. And I also think it was interesting that Noel Gallagher there, when he was talking to Gay, that there's a severity to the Gallaghers, if you like. There's a razor sharp severity to them, how they deal with the world, how did they deal with one another, obviously, after all these years. But there was a great tenderness and a great love for that time in Ireland when he used to come here in the summers. And I think that that's an important thing for us, that sense of place. I think it's important that we know where we come from and that we have a connection with it.
Well, I started this by saying, does it happen anymore? What are you observing, Jim?
Well, I remember going to America back in the late 70s, the early 80s, and I was absolutely amazed that people used to phone ahead before they'd go anywhere to visit anybody.
Yeah.
That you'd call ahead to make sure that the coast... Whereas here in Ireland, people just wandered in and wandered out. And I can remember rambling. People just... They could be coming back, bringing back a piece of machinery they borrowed, or coming to borrow a piece of machinery. And they'd come in and there would be tea and there'd be chat. And there were houses, there were rambling houses, that every night there were people who went in. And if you went into that house, there would always be a few there and there would always be chat. As somebody said to me, the kettle in that house, there is always a wisp of tea steam coming off the kettle because it was always on the boil. And I can remember that it was really just rambling, going into one another. And I suppose it was the way people kept in touch, and it was the way people found out the news and that sort of thing. And I think it's still possible, you know, aside from the electric gates. So you might have to talk to a gatepost before you get to see people. But for instance, I can remember a few years ago, or last year here, we were putting together a kind of community text system. But we had to get permission from everybody to go on the text system, you know, so that we'd send out notices of things that were happening in the area. And I had to get on my bike and go around to the neighbours and to people, houses I hadn't been in, asking them if they're happy to put their mobile phone numbers on this. And I had just a few fantastic evenings, you know. And every house I went into, it wasn't a question of standing at the door.
Are you sure, Jim?
I did.
Are you sure you didn't knock at the door and they'd put their coat on and say, "Oh, sorry, we're just on the way out"?
Yes.
Are you positive they wanted you?
I'm absolutely positive, because I suppose you're referring there to a story I had in the paper a few weeks ago. There was a friend of mine and he knew this woman, and she had an excellent way of filtering unwanted visitors. That she always had her coat hanging at the back of the door, her good coat. And when the knock would come in the door and she'd open it, if it was somebody that she didn't like, she'd always be pulling on the coat. And if it was somebody she didn't like, she'd say, "I was just going out, you're very unlucky. Would you call again? I have an embarrassment." And if it was someone she liked, she'd say, "Oh, you're very lucky, I'm just in. Come in, let's take off the coat." And so that was her filter.
Well, I can tell you one thing, Jim. If you rang my doorbell, I'd give you the latter option. Come in, sit down, we'll have a good chat. Because I could talk to you all day, but I can't, because I have to go and take an ad break very soon. But we're going to encourage people to go rambling, aren't we? Particularly
we are,
as the winter comes in And, you know, there's loneliness and all that out there.
There is, and you'd be amazed that somebody, especially since COVID, people are still not going out that much, and people are still kind of scared a small bit. So I'd encourage people just to go, and you'd be, and as I said, when I was going around there last year, when you knock on people's doors unannounced, it's amazing how delighted they are to see somebody and to have a chat and maybe to get a bit of news and to give you a bit of news, which is really important as well.
Well, I hope your wife has a bit of luck over that laptop and gets her tickets. Jim O'Brien, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. There is no website for rambling. There's no phone number. Just the fine art of making a call in on a neighbour and hope they don't have their hat ready to go out the door. And just a reminder, your second volume of Matters of Great Indifference by Jim O'Brien is in the shops now. Have a great day, Jim. Good luck with the tickets. We'll take a break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
And you're very welcome back to Countrywide this morning. So many of you have been in touch to say it was lovely to hear Jill Smith talking to Ella earlier on in the programme. What an amazing woman. Absolutely, a gorgeous, gorgeous woman. And Maura has just texted us in on 51551. And she says, Brenda, brought up in Dublin in the 50s to parents both from the Burn and Clare. Our heaven was summers travelling in a Morris Minor to boat farms in Carron and Listenvarna. And the magic of spending those summers with our uncles, aunts, cousins and grandparents in the bog and in the meadow saving hay. The magic of it all. We loved it so much. Wonderful memories of the oil lamps being lit at night. And the loo was, what? Oh, and the loo was put under the bed. no electricity, wonderful conversations, memories forever. Thank you, Maura, for sharing that with us. Now, once upon a time, Irish wool was a very valuable, it was used for clothing and later on for carpets. But times and tastes and breeds of sheep have changed. And nowadays, the price of getting a sheep shorn is probably greater than the price a farmer will get for a fleece. In effect, wool has become an unwanted byproduct of the sheep industry. There are moves afoot to change this. The Irish Grown Wool Council is one initiative. Another initiative is down in County Wicklow. There, Zoe Daly and Lionel Mackey have been on a quest to find an Irish wool from which they can make their knits and woven blankets. Against all conventional wisdom, they have managed to create a fine quality Irish grown wool. And Suzanne Campbell went to find out more and met some friendly sheep as she arrived on the farm.
Come on. Come on, go girls. Come on.
She likes that bucket of food.
They're like the alpha sheep in the flock. So she follows the bucket, so they all follow her.
Yeah.
It's great.
Near Dinard in County Wicklow, I'm looking at businessman and farmer Lionel Mackey's sheep. These Romney and blue-faced Leicesters are a little unusual around here, as they are bred not just for meat, but for their wool.
They've got a really big frame.
They're quite
a tall sheep.
Yeah.
While the Romney is more of a kind of a stocky breed. Blueface are bringing milk to the table and a big frame. The Romney would be, I suppose, more of a dual-purpose breed,
okay.
for the factory and for the wool.
So my granny, 9 years ago from Sligo, she hand-knit me a baby blanket for my daughter. And I just thought it was the best thing I'd ever had as a new mother. You know, you're getting to know all these things and you're worried about the baby. Is it too hot, too cold? Is it sweating? Can it breathe? And wool, this wool blanket seemed to have all the answers.
Zoe Daly is Lionel's partner and it was her journey to find Irish wool and Irish wool products that led her to this farm.
Wool is temperature regulating, it's breathable, cellular, fire resistant, antibacterial, anti-dust, all of these things. So I just kind of started becoming obsessed with wool. Mm. And also the idea that, you know, a handmade item, it's very much in our heritage, but it's a rare thing to get as well. So I just thought, as a little business idea, wouldn't it be great to emulate this? Go get beautiful wool, get it handmade and sell it as a product, because I noticed it's a dying art. So I thought for the story, it would be nice to go to the farm, get the wool, do the traceability and get it handmade. So I went into a wool shop and I said, can I have your finest Irish wool? And they looked at me like I had two heads. And they said, well, we don't do Irish wool. And I was like, what? There's millions of sheep in the country. And that was the point then I started on this journey.
From this point, Zoe set out to research what Irish wool was available, if any, and if it could be spun into yarns for knitting and for fabrics. In recent years, the price of wool has collapsed, and most farmers in Ireland make a loss once they pay the shearer to shear their sheep. It has to be sent to the UK for washing, processing, and is usually only suitable for carpets or insulation. But Zoe continued on in her search.
You know, from the research alone, we know we were world leaders in wool production for centuries. Like an Irish wool cloak was a gift in the courts of France in the 15th century, regarded as a luxury item for the sultans in the Middle East. We have this incredible history of wool. So I went around collecting wool in the back of my car, smelly fleeces with my daughter telling me the car smelled. And I posted it to England because there was nowhere to process it. I became friends with a woman over there who owned a mill who was passionate about the tragedy of Ireland as well, because she was saying Irish wool is fantastic. It has huge potential. And she helped me kind of curate a blend of two breeds that would work for this idea. Mm-hmm. I posted her over wool and what I got back was gold.
Oh, yeah. This is so fine.
Yeah, that's our new lace shawl.
So soft.
So you can feel it. It's
in a warehouse on the farm, Zoe and Lionel collect wool, milling equipment that they've bought to process wool, and finished blankets and garments made from their own wool and the wool from Romney and blue-faced Leicester sheep from other farms. So the products we have in front of us, I mean, they're beautiful. They've got a kind of a honeycomb stitch. Baby blankets, you've got sweaters on the rail there. The feel of them is just extraordinary.
This is our blend of Romney and Blue Face. Yeah, at this point, all the washing has to happen in the UK.
Yeah.
Then we send it to Donegal Yarns currently, who are spinning it for us. And again, the future picture is to take this all back to Ireland, you know, which will happen in phases. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at really scaling up the supply with the farming end. So we're encouraging farmers to start working again with these breeds, which are going to work for them. Essentially, we're going to be able to provide a place where we can take in all this wool and do a totally vertical system. So we'll be washing it on site and then we'll be spinning it as well. And we'll also always look to work with the experts like in Donegal Yarns who've taught us how to use our yarn, other experts, consultants we work with in the UK who are teaching us, because we have lost these skills in Ireland with Irish wool. We almost don't know what we can do with it.
They were shorn at the end of July.
July.
So they were, yeah.
Okay. And where is that wool now?
It's stored in the shed for the moment, but I'll be doing my wool run next week and it'll be coming with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have farmers with Blueface Leicesters and with Romneys all around Ireland and you're trying to grow that number. I mean, if farmers listening to this were interested in this story and producing Irish wool from start to finish, what would entice them to keep these animals, the Romney and the Blueface?
Well, first of all, if any farmer out there has Romney or a Blueface Leicester sheep, give us a shout.
Okay.
Like literally look up our phone number on the website, aru.eu. Mm-hmm. Like we're paying 10 times the market price for that wool at the moment.
Okay. But it has to be shorn and handled well right from the beginning.
Absolutely. It has to be clean.
Right.
No damp wool or dags in it or, you know, any dip dye or it has to be clean. But we're paying like a premium though as well. But yeah, you have to like put a mark in the sand. You have to put a value on Irish wool again. It's the only way it's going to work. If the farmer's not incentivized, there's going to be no supply.
You really do believe the time is ripe to get a wool industry back in Ireland?
It's a world mega trend going back to natural fibres. And wool is a natural fibre.
Wool is sustainable, lasts for an entire lifetime, can be handed down, has all these regenerative abilities. And it's just an incredible miracle biofibre. Now, there is a huge turning back to this, even globally. So it's just about creating the spaces and places that we can process this and make it viable.
And that was Lionel Mackey and Zoe Daly chatting to Suzanne Campbell. And their website is uru.eu, E-R-I-U.eu. And Lionel says they might even be able to provide you with a market for your wool if you're sheep farming. So thank you very much there from Suzanne Campbell. Now, it's been a tough year for farming. But how has the summer of 2024 been for small tourism businesses focused on farms in rural Ireland? Official figures will be released in the coming weeks by Fáilte Ireland on the 2024 season, capturing the picture across the country and across different sectors. Now, some farms have diversified into tourism to provide another stream of income. So this morning, we have our own small snapshot, not very scientific, but a snapshot that will give you a sense of what the issues might be. I'm joined by Catherine O'Grady-Power from Glenkeen Farm, on the road from Lewisburg in County Mayo to Lenan in County Galway, by Keith Gogan from Gangola Mines in County Galway, and Margaret Leahy of Fable Tours, who brings tourists to farms to experience Irish culture food from farm to fork. Good morning to you all.
Good morning,
good morning,
Brenda.
Good morning, Brenda.
I don't think you've done your yoga this morning. That was very quiet. Can I start with you, Catherine? In a nutshell, can you describe what you offer tourists down in Glenkeen Farm?
Thanks for having me on, Brenda. Greetings from a very sunny Mayo here today.
Woohoo!
Glenkeen, well, we provide cultural visitor experiences, and we diversified our working sheep farm in 2015 to open a state-of-the-art visitor centre. So while it's still a working sheep farm, and I was very interested in your previous speaker on the wool, we provide sheepdog herding demonstrations, we have historical walking tours, and we're very fortunate here, Brenda, that we have sites dating back to the Bronze Age, and we have tactile famine historical and folklore experiences. We also provide wool spinning experiences with a wonderful lady, June Burke, and she provides a back-to-back experience, literally from the back of our sheep to the back of the human. Irish music, group and private dining experiences.
Catherine,
and we've a wonderful team here. It is indeed.
Can I ask Keith now what they do? I know they had a good experience on their farm at the beginning of the season. It doesn't rain in the mines, so what do you offer tourists, Keith?
Hi, Brenda, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, well, I suppose we're a family farm business as well. I set up about 25 years ago. We developed an old 18th century silver and lead mine. And we had to restore it and bring it back to be able to bring people underground. And we bring them back to show them the history and heritage of what people, how they worked and lived in Connemara back in the early times and how they survived. I found that it probably wouldn't survive on its own without doing something else. So we opened a small shop. So we sell it. We have a gift shop, a rock and gem shop. We sell souvenirs and wool and all that. And with that, we were always asked by visitors coming, well, you know, about your farm and all that. And, you know, we took it for granted. And we started doing a sheepdog demonstration then about 15 years ago and showing people how we work our sheep and what we do with the sheep and our way of life as farmers. And you know what, it was really on him. I realized how fascinated people were about what we did. You know, we took it for granted. And we live on the peat bogs as well. So we cut the turf and show them how we cut turf and what we do. And when all those three or four things come together, it really makes you a business on a farm alongside farming sheep.
All right, that's brilliant. And can I ask Margaret there, sorry Keith for cutting across you there, because I just want to kind of look at the whole tourism section. But Margaret, can you briefly tell us, you bring tourists up lanes and by roads to visit farms. What does a day out with your Fable Tours mean?
Yeah, good morning, Brenda. The focus on Fable Tours are farm-to-table tours and tales. So, yes, we do farm visits. We, who are, in my opinion, are our primary food producers. And we hear their stories. Why are they doing what they do? Why do they love what they do? How do they end up? Because some of them may have a lifelong been on farms and some of them have come back to it for whatever reason. And we sample the food, obviously. We dine in cafes and restaurants that focus on local food. And it's really about making connection, Brenda, between our primary food producers, our farmers, and what ends up literally on our plate. And we have such a rich food here. I mean, it's just fantastic. I mean, you go to other countries and they say, oh, it's farm fed beef, or sorry, grass-fed beef. All of our beef is grass-fed. So, you know, I love bringing guests to meet the farmers, to taste the food, whether it's dairy or meat or our wonderful seafood. And a day out is all about walking the fields, meeting the farmers, meeting the fishers, meeting the innovative chefs. And
amazing.
It's just a wonderful way to experience Irish life.
Well, that is amazing. So really, you all have great products in rural Galway and Mayo. But what have you noticed about the summer season that has just passed? Catherine, what are you thinking?
Thanks, Brenda. This year, we have experienced a notable decline in our EU, UK and domestic visitor numbers, and a significant increase in our US market. And actually, our US customer base constitutes about 85% of our business now, mainly from North America. And while that's wonderful and it's great for US customers here now with the strength of the dollar, the risk now is our business has an over-reliance on the US market. And issues like that would have affected the other markets would be a lack of accommodation. For instance, we had 3 tour series cancellations this year where the accommodation factor was an issue. They would have historically stayed in hotels in Mayo, which were no longer available because the hotels are now hosting the refugees and so forth. So there are a number of issues affecting business at the moment.
And but why it's going down.
Would be,
yeah. On the US market. So, but Keith, at the start of the season, I think it was okay for you. But what happened there July and August?
Well, I suppose we get a lot of our bookings for tour groups. I'll just talk about tour groups in October. And they'd all book their slots. And then come March and April, February and March, they'd start giving you numbers of what they had. And then, you know, we were getting a lot of cancellations from tour companies, the same as what Catherine is saying, because they couldn't stay in the West. They were coming from Burr and Tullamore and in the Midlands, staying in hotels in Ballinasloe. And the biggest problem was they were an hour and a half driving or 2 hours, and they were focusing on maybe doing two to three things in Connemara on the day. And with the time lost in the bus travelling, they had to drop one. And sadly, the smaller industries were being dropped more so than the bigger ones because they were all the highlights of the tours. And for us, we saw a big decline when the demand for hotel rooms would happen and we'd lose the business that way. But there was a very good early season and a great spend from the visitors we had. But once when June started to come, it which goes down a little bit anyway, it changed, and July never really took off for us as a tourism industry. No, it was good. I can't complain about it, but it wasn't nowhere near what we were expecting it to be.
I just want to ask Margaret, because I'm just thinking of you going up and down the roads and the country lanes and everything, Margaret. Was transport or is transport becoming an issue for you in sustaining your business?
Absolutely. I think that's the big difference between rural tourism and urban tourism. So, you know, you can do a walking tour of any city, but if you're going to do a food tour with me, you have to either have your own transport or I have to hire it. So there's an additional cost straight away. And there's very often a shortage of smaller, I deal with small groups up to like 15. So there can be a shortage of that size bus and drivers. I know a lot of bus companies are shouting out for more drivers. And like Catherine was saying, the domestic market for me this year has fallen completely. We thankfully, I still have North American clients and that, but the domestic market this year has definitely been very, very poor. And it's understandable with the weather. But again, it is a transport issue, because if you have a group of friends and you want to come to Galway City for a thing, to come out to me, you have to have transport or I have to organise it. So there's always that additional cost, which makes doing things in rural areas that bit more expensive, Brenda.
Well, look, we have lots to talk about. The report from Fáilte Ireland will be out over the next few weeks. There'll be a lot of issues there, but we've highlighted some of what you're experiencing in your small businesses on farms around the country. A reminder, though, guys, the season is not quite over yet. There are still people looking for a holiday in Ireland in September and October. And I hope all of you have a better end to your season. Catherine, Keith, Margaret, thank you so much for talking to me on Countrywide. Much appreciated. Have a great day, guys. Enjoy the beautiful fine weather in Mayo and Galway. Now, I was going to say the blackberries are out. Margaret would love this. And the hedgerows, I'm all obsessed with Oasis tickets. But the blackberries are ripening on the hedgerows. And down in the old garden near County Clane in County Kildare, summer is mellowing into autumn. Pat Pender and his volunteers have created a garden that grows plants, flowers and vegetables and cultivates a warm and thriving community, as I discovered when I called in yesterday.
Our hens live on vegetables at this time of the year because they're such an abundance. We have apple peas and apple cores and they love it, and they sweeten up their eggs nicely as well.
Pat Pender, what a beautiful day to be here in the old garden. This is somewhere you spend 99% of your life.
All my waking hours are spent here looking after hens, ducks, giving advice to people if they need it, because I was born gardener. My father was a gardener and I learned all my bits and pieces of gardening from him. Sort of brought it on to here now, and there's other people here with expertise, but there's not people with none or very little, so we're teaching them how to do it.
How old are you, Pat?
I am 85. Now, what is so special to me is the first of all is to see these people here, so many people sowing, working, looking after their food. At this stage, they're starting to reap it. That is what this whole project is about. That's what I'm about, trying to get as many people into growing their own food as possible. This 20 acres here, developing 7.5 acres, the other half is going to be part of a community farm. So we have a lot going on. When I retired, I was at a loss what to do. My wife was the look, used to after the flowers and everything for her living. And she just asked me one day, will you cut the hedge for me? And I did. And that got me going again and got it all back. So I got involved then in the community garden, set it up, helped to set it up, run it. One of the things I found when I retired, there was nothing to do. There was no reason to get up out of bed. And then after about 3 weeks, I had enough of it. And then this happened, and here I am. Now, Carmel and myself spent all our time up here that we have. Some people talk about holidays. Well, we say this is our holiday. Sometimes you'd be feeling a bit under the weather, you'd be a bit down, you come up here and you get in among the hens and the ducks, and all of a sudden everything is gone. Because you have hens that come up around your feet, they're kind of pets at this stage, and they just have that effect that they just take all that gloom away.
No, if I got spring onions and I've got green manure to put down for the winter, the green manure could self-seed.
We can share.
Jenny and Michelle, your allotment are very close to each other. Tell me a little bit about yourself, Michelle.
I probably did the allotment because the kids are a little bit older, one in secondary and one sixth class. So looking for something to do. Meet new people, grow some veg. Garden is a bit small. Something different to do.
And Michelle, two allotments up is Jenny.
Yes.
Hi, Jenny.
Hiya.
You both live near each other but didn't know each other, is that right?
Pass by our house every time I'm walking.
Yeah. Admired my garden.
I did, actually. Yeah. I did.
You did admire my garden.
And now I can poke my head in and say hi.
Yeah, now you can come in. Yeah.
And I've actually found since doing this, I'm stopping and talking to more people, actually. So you do get into conversations that you might not have otherwise got into.
It's lovely to get your hands into the soil and just get a bit dirty, that sounds bad, but just to get back to it, you mean, because we spend our whole life just stressing out with lists of things to do, and you come up here and time just passes. You don't get half what you want done, but you know what I mean, you feel you've done something. Like I got my potatoes up a few days ago and I got my onions up and have them stored, and I feel I've did something. And I think the allotment kind of grounds you, brings you back down to earth. It makes you feel good about yourself.
Well, if I can interrupt there, it's Kevin, isn't it?
It is. Kevin Mullen. I'm from Selbridge, Brenda. I'm just strimming out one section that I haven't yet really cultivated. I work on raised beds because as we get on, it becomes easier to use the raised beds rather than digging everything into the ground. Potatoes that you see there, they're dug into the ground, so they take a little bit of work. But it's easy enough once you get some cultivation on it there.
You are so passionate about this.
It's so
good. What is it for you?
It's just such an amazing amazing place. You can come up here and you have real neighbours like we used to have way, way back when I was a child. We can talk, we can socialise. Sometimes you come up here and you spend half your time just having a chat, swapping produce as well too, you know, because we always grow too much of one thing and not enough of another. But it's absolutely fabulous for your health, both physically and mentally.
Can I ask what age are you?
I am 73 years old.
You know you don't look it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You're working with nature, but nature always throws up lots of problems for you too, so you have to figure those out. And we're always learning. I mean, I've been doing it for over 20 years, allotments now, and every day I learn something new. It's just wonderful. A couple of years before I was due to retire, I got colorectal cancer. And at the time I was up in my allotment or whatever, it took me out of everything for about 6 months as I did chemotherapy. But the real therapy was getting back onto the allotments. That's what really got me back into it. Plus, my family were an amazing help during that time. I'm completely clear now. And you're never bored. You're actually doing something that works every muscle in your body when you're out in the allotment.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you? Hiya. I'm coming into your allotment here. Feels like I'm coming into your house.
Yeah.
Who have we got here? What's your name?
So I'm Maureen.
And I'm Paul.
And are you together?
We are. Yeah. We are. Yeah. 42 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Long enough.
So this is like a second home here, the allotment, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
Yeah. Proper garden.
This is our oasis.
We've a tiny garden in Maynooth. We've always wanted to grow vegetables. My dad used to grow vegetables and his dad used to grow vegetables.
Yeah.
So now we're beginners. Like, we've only been at it for a couple of years, but this is just unbelievable. It's magic. So we've Brussels sprouts, they'll keep growing, so we'll have them for Christmas, which is magic. Yeah. Never had our own Brussels sprouts before.
We've got kale behind that.
Enough kale to feed an army. So we've kind of deformed carrots. We're learning about the whole thing. You know what I mean? The soil needs to be better. Onions.
And then we've got kale down here.
But we're just putting stuff in. Yeah. We're trying it out, and we don't care.
We come out here for our dates.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we have coffee in the car, so we'll have a little coffee and look at the mountains in the distance. And like, you've all this open space, and we both love it. It's soul food in every way. It's good for both of us, and it's good for each of us separately.
So really being part of the allotment with Maureen here, it's just given us enjoyment. Watching things grow and then harvesting it and then eating it, like ground to plate in 15 minutes. It's unbelievable.
And to find out more about this magical place, visit theoldgarden.ie. That is all we have time for on Countrywide today. Thank you to the wonderful team. Brian O'Connell brings you a playback. He's up right next. And brace yourselves, as they say, Philip Boucher-Hayes is back on the programme next week. Until I speak to you again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.